Hello, I'm Ari Pincus with the American Communities Project. Today I'm speaking with Timothy Carney, author of the forthcoming book, Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. Tim, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
I just wanted to start off with, what made you decide to write this book?
So it was Donald Trump. When Trump was doing well in the early polls in the primary and saying the American dream was dead, that was the setup line in his opening speech. He said, the American dream is dead. That was a setup for, we're going to make America great again. And I interpreted from going to early events that that was really the defining characteristic of his earliest support. So that 15% of the Republican electorate that just immediately jumped to him, they were jumping to the notion that the American dream was dead. And I wanted to know why. And there's a lot of different explanations. Some was, this has to do with factory closures. Some were, oh, this is about the fact that women have, and minorities now have more equal rights, and this is old men, old white guys angry that they're losing some of their privilege, and that's why they think it's dead. There were all these different explanations, and so I thought I would try to figure it out. So I spent most of 2016 with that, and that was the project of the book, was to figure out why the American dream seemed dead to so many people.
You begin by describing your personal history in the midst of a difficult time for your family. Could you talk about the meaning that you gleaned from that period of time?
So yeah, this was my daughter who was 1 year old at the time. I remember it clearly. We're Catholic, and because the baby was sick, we couldn't all go to the 8:30 mass that we normally go to. So I went with the middle kids while the baby stayed home with my wife. My wife went with our oldest child while I stayed home. And while the baby was really declining, I was trying to call my wife. But of course, you don't have your phone on during church. And so then I ended up running down the street with her in a stroller to get her to an urgent care center. In the end, my wife brought her to a hospital, and they then had to send her on to children's hospital. And so it was this incredibly sort of terrifying day that then soon gave way to just a long slog of recovery. And there was always at least one of us in the hospital with the baby. That meant that we were relying on neighbors, we were relying on family, we were relying on other people to watch our other kids, take them to school, pick them up from school, while we spent a week going to and from the hospital in D.C. from our home in Maryland. And one of the things I noticed, it was a nurse asked me, oh, somebody else sent you food. Who was that? And I said, oh, that was somebody from our neighborhood pool. Oh, who was that visitor? That was somebody I work with. Well, you just got this gift card. What's that from? Oh, I used to be on the board of that nonprofit. And so the nonprofits. And I had never thought of my friends and connections in this way, but I realized there was an institution connecting my wife and me to each of these things, whether it was schools, our parish, I mean, family, obviously, but also work. And former places, sort of professional involvement, that we had this incredibly thick net of civil society that provided this safety net. But it was also this one detail that I remember particularly fondly, was my wife was running out of mass when she finally looked at her phone, wondered why it was buzzing like crazy, and just turned to our daughter and just said, go stay at mass, because it's important as a Catholic to attend. Somebody else will give you a ride home. So Dory, who's a friend of a mom of an old friend, will probably give you a ride home. And if not, somebody else will. And that idea of just, we're going to throw our kid into this building where we aren't, and we know that she's going to be taken care of, is a level of trust that we didn't even think twice about in our parish. And I realized that there might not be institutions like that for a lot of people.
Right. That is fascinating. If you had to capture your premise in an elevator pitch, why do some places thrive while others collapse?
Places collapse if they are not planted with institutions of civil society that connect people together and provide a sense of purpose. The places that thrive have those institutions, and in America, for the middle class, those institutions are mostly church. Otherwise, the elites, I use that word to describe communities that are chock full of college-educated people, the elites build other institutions in addition to church, but the places that collapse tend to be places that lack a big number of college-educated people and lack strong religious institutions. So middle-class places collapse in America if they don't have a strong religious institution there.
You make a lot of really interesting links in the book, and I wondered if you could describe the link between a place's social capital and its voting result in the 2016 Republican primary.
So, yeah, when I talk about Trump support in the book, I'm almost always talking about the Republican primaries. The general election, there's two choices, there's so many confounding factors. But especially in early primaries, when there were 17 people on the ballot in Iowa, there was choosing Donald Trump was, again, my hypothesis was that it was an expression of the idea that the American dream was dead. And it was borne out by the data in Iowa, in that the counties with sort of the best measures of social capital were Trump's worst counties. And Trump's best counties were the counties with the lowest measures. And so the ones with the best measures of social capital fit into two categories. One, you could say three categories. One, the elites. Two of the most educated counties in America are in Iowa, and they were two of Trump's worst counties in the whole country. But then two, particularly strong religious communities. So up in northwestern Iowa is Sioux County, where like everybody is Dutch. They're Dutch Reformed. They go to church twice on Sundays. There's two Dutch Reformed colleges there. This was Trump's worst county in Iowa by far. And the other bad counties included, where Des Moines was, where Iowa State was, where the University of Iowa were. His best counties, best big county, was Pottawatomie County, which is where Council Bluffs is. That's where I go as a political journalist every caucus, every 4 years. There was a lot of people I see every 4 years. The Trump contingent was people, huge number first-time attendees. They didn't even have a leader. Every other, Jeb Bush had a precinct captain in every precinct there, even if he's only getting five supporters in a precinct. Trump had the most people in that room in Pottawatomie County, but then they just sort of disbanded at the end. Council Bluffs is, Pottawatomie has the worst social capital scores of any big county in Iowa. It's Trump's best big county. The small county that was Trump's best county overall, where he got more than 40% in the caucuses, is the county that was dead last on the University of Pennsylvania social capital measures in the previous year.
Very interesting. It's another link that you make between the skills of the unskilled factory workers and the skills of marriage and fatherhood. How are they linked, and what are the implications of this?
So I call this the Joe Adams effect. In 2005, there was a factory in Bloomington, Indiana, shutting down. And I stopped by the union hall, and the union, the number two guy, the vice president there, was losing his job. And I just asked him a little about how he got into factory work. And he said, I was kind of surprised when I first wanted a factory job. They asked me if I had experience. Joe responded, so what do I need experience for? This is unskilled labor, right? If you've ever been in a factory, a lot of it, you're surprised. It's you pick up a tool, you drive in a rivet, and then you do it again. You could imagine being trained in one day for this job. And they said, you know what we want from experience? We want to know, do you show up on time? Do you wait till the whistle to take your lunch, come back before lunch is over, and then stay till the whistle to end? Do you only call in sick when you're actually sick? And are you willing to stick around and do this mundane thing for decades? Again, this was 2005. This was before I was married and had kids. Years later, when I was thinking about Joe Adams, I realized this is a prerequisite for being a dad. Can you show up on time, stay for as long as you needed, pick up basic unskilled tasks like changing a diaper and, not burning the scrambled eggs, and commit yourself to something that at times might be crazy making, and you're going to commit to it for decades. And I thought this was important because I realized that factories provided, they cultivated these skills of the unskilled. You could call them basic virtues. And that places that lost those factories lost sort of a training ground for those virtues. While if you go to college, if you go to a high school that expects you to go to college, a lot of those same things are there. While for the working class, the factory was the prime training ground for those skills of the unskilled, which then blend into the prerequisites, so to speak, for marriage and a family. And I included that because, the data show across the board that the retreat from marriage in America is mostly happening in the working class. And this is one of my explanations for that, is that the loss of the factory job, the reliable gig, has meant that there's less cultivation of those sort of basic virtues.
That's a really good point. What can we all learn from the natural experiment presented by man camps, those that were set up by oil companies in North Dakota?
Yeah, so in Williston, they had to do this. They imported effectively had to import lots of workers, but they also had to pay them a lot of money. I mean, it was $18 an hour for unskilled labor was starting. If you had a commercial driver's license, you were making six figures because this was fracking central. And I went out there to look at it. And one of the things that I realized, the man camp is this sort of warren of trailers. And the rooms are actually fairly nice. It's a flat screen TV, a nice bed, good lighting. You are sharing a bathroom, but only with three other people. Then there's these massive quadruple wide trailers with ping pong tables, all you can eat fast food and, 24 hours a day and big screen TVs for watching the game. And it was like, I remember thinking when I was in college, if I got to like design a student union, this is what it would look like. It was just sort of dude, heaven. But there was a study of these various fracking communities because what was the rare thing that was going on here? Blue-collar guys were getting a lot of money. So if we saw that the loss of good jobs, of these good factory jobs, preceded the retreat from marriage among the working class, the return of good jobs for the people without a college education should hopefully bring a return to marriage and family formation. It didn't happen in Williston, and it also didn't happen in these other fracking towns, as studied by Melissa Carney, who's at, not related to me, not spelled the same. She's at Brookings. She actually focused at other places besides just Williston because Williston was so dramatic. But the lesson of Williston for me was this isn't a real human community. It's everything's just sort of provided for you. You are giving labor and they're giving you money, which may sound like what all work is, but you realize most jobs are different. They're more relational. Most places are more geared towards family formation. But in general, in these fracking towns, these were blue-collar places where like Williston, they just didn't quite have the institutions, or in Pennsylvania or Ohio, the institutions had collapsed. You can't just bring in money and restore family because you can't just immediately pop back up the crucial institutions of civil society.
Good point. What surprised you most in your research?
Well, one thing that surprised me most is that if you compared me to myself 12 years ago, that I would find the phrase, it takes a village to raise a family, to not only be true, but profound. This was, of course, Hillary Clinton's book title. And to me, as a conservative, it sounded like some collectivist thing. And that a lot of my individualism faded away a little bit while writing this, realizing that obviously as a parent, I never thought that my wife and I were doing this on our own. I never would have said those words, but realizing that it wasn't just that we relied on this help and we had this help, but that the whole undertaking a family formation requires this support structure of community, of multiple institutions. So that's sort of definitely the way in which my thinking was most cemented in a new direction. For other conservative friends of mine, one of the most surprising things is to find out that sort of the liberal elites practice what we social conservatives preach all the time. They finish school, they get a job, they get married, they stay involved in their kids' life. I address in the book what I call the Lena Dunham fallacy, this belief that liberal elites, college-educated elites, are all graduating from Wesleyan and then never getting married, and if they have children, it's deliberately out of wedlock and no regard for the traditional family. That's not the way it works. If you go to a place, one of the places I go in the book, Chevy Chase, Maryland, about 10 miles from my house, it's overwhelmingly Democratic. It's overwhelmingly wealthy and educated. If you go to a place like Chevy Chase, you will see them, again, living the sort of traditional family life of finishing school, getting a job, getting married, having kids, staying married. Divorce rates in sort of these circles are lower by far than average. And being involved in their kids' life and coaching T-ball, and frankly, even going to church at a higher rate than I would have suspected. You go into Blessed Sacrament in Chevy Chase on the D.C. Maryland line, and it's going to be more packed than the Catholic Church in rural Pennsylvania might be.
That is fascinating. Can I ask where education fits into the framework about the decline of civil society?
So this is interesting because I think one of the places a lot of people thought I would talk more about was education, but I guess I see school as being another institution of civil society, not dramatically different. And by that I mean a good school. When people say, oh, I'm going to send my kids to good school, it doesn't primarily mean that there's some extra skilled teachers there or more technology. What it primarily means is that the other parents are very involved in the school. And so school can be a very strong institution of civil society, but it only does that in certain communities. I talked about the elite and the strong religious communities. That's where school serves that purpose. Whether you have upper middle class people who have more flexible jobs and are more able to volunteer during school hours, or that's a lot of it, or more able to just predict their schedule and coach a T-ball team. Or whether it's a religious community with more stay-at-home moms and, you know, middle-class lifestyle, and so they're more able to show up and do it. And just parents who sort of put a high value on education, more of those people in a community make the school be more of an institution where it's a training ground, a meeting ground for the other parents. In when you look at the very strong correlation between income and test scores that happens in schools, that's incredibly depressing. One of my arguments is that and some of this I base on Robert Putnam in his book, Our Kids. He says the important thing here is that all the other activities that spin out of the school, the clubs, the things that bring the parents together, the schools where there's fewer intact families, so more single parents, more blue-collar jobs, so unpredictable, longer hours that are less flexible, they're not as able to be strong institutions. So that, I would say, that's my diagnosis of why sort of schools in some places produce much better outcomes. It's a little depressing in some ways because it means that there's no easy fix to this, because you can't sort of snap your fingers or pass a new funding bill and create a ton more intact families and involved parents in a school district. There's deeper systemic things that have to do with the strength of community.
And what did you see in the field about how young people were impacted by the decline in civil society?
The data show across the board worse outcomes for people who grow up in places with worse social capital and weaker communities. Raj Chetty is a researcher who found that the number one predictor of upward mobility by children was the number of intact families locally. And the number two was measures of social capital. So family and community are the keys to providing a better future materially, but also as far as drug use and teen pregnancy, a lot of those things are predicted by these sort of things. And when I would find in, you know, in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, a young married couple with a kid, there was a sense of being sort of hunkered down, of being against trying to stay married and raise their kid was making them trying to resist the tide of where they lived, as opposed to, again, in an elite circle, you get married, you have a kid, that's sort of the expectation that it's going to work out. And I found that was one of the things I remember from Uniontown. I was talking to this couple that was basically saying, we're going to beat this place, meaning we're going to be successful, stay married, and raise our kids. They were trying to overcome the culture in a way that I never felt that particular sort of counter pressure.
That's really interesting. How would you cast your findings after the 2018 elections?
So in 2018, notably, Democrats did well in places that Trump had won that were sort of the Rust Belt or working class places. So Trump had won Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin. And in all three of those states, Democrats won all the big statewide races. And this, I predicted this in a New York Times piece I wrote ahead of the election, because I said some people thought that Trump had brought about a realignment, bringing the people, working class communities, into the Republican Party. He certainly didn't do that. I mean, the Republican Party still stands for certain ideas, you know, lower taxes, pro-life Christian conservative thing. That's not the agenda of the American working class. But more importantly, I thought that the vote for Trump, again, was a vote that the American dream was dead. And some of the very same people had cast that, were saying the same thing when they voted for Obama, especially in 2008, and also in 2012. And so I wasn't surprised to see counties in Michigan go Obama, then Trump, and then go Democrat again in 2018. It's not an ideological expression, their vote, as much as it is an expression of saying things are thoroughly broken all the way to the bottom.
Got it. What do you think the media are still missing about the Trump supporters in depressed places, and why do you think they're missing the picture?
I think they're missing mostly the fact that it's a local phenomenon, it's a cultural phenomenon, and it's a very real phenomenon. Some people will chalk it up as pure economics. That's what I think sometimes the populists on the right, they oversimplify it to say the problem is just that the steel jobs are lost. The oversimplification on the left is to say it's cultural anxiety and then skip ahead to say, oh, this is just backwards and bigotry and that sort of thing. They don't see that there really is a real loss there. So I think what they're both missing is the nature and the depth of the loss, that it's not just that the factory shut down. It's that after the factory shut down, one of the churches had to shut down, and the people then didn't go to the next church over. They stopped going to church, and the coffee shop where people meet shut down. So that the loss is there, that it's real, that it's too simplistic to say it's just economic, and that it's not going to go away. A, Trump's not going to fix it, and B, if Trump goes away one way or another, the problem's not going to go away.
Moving on to that note, what are your top line recommendations for reinvigorating civil society?
So it has to happen on the local level. And so this is where the sort of last chapter doesn't have a lot of big federal legislation that can solve it, because there's no, restore local institutions of civil society bill. But on the community level, I think, first of all, I would just say, if anybody who is at near the top of an institution of any sort that has any stability should just say, wait a second, we are the ones who are going to help people's lives be better. So if you're running a church in Fayette County, Pennsylvania, you have to think, maybe what I thought was a job of some government agency or what I thought was a job of a nonprofit geared towards helping drug addicts is my job. Not to just necessarily provide the acute treatment, but to build an infrastructure. If you want people to get married, you can't preach to them about the importance of marriage. You have to build a culture where a society where there's support and modeling for that. So that would sort of be my advice, to see anybody who's got sort of their hands on the wheel of an institution to realize that they are the backbone of the American dream. I'd also, a lot of it is on an individual level. Yeah, go to church and start a t-ball team. That's what I try to do. Even while writing this book, I started a t-ball team and coached kindergarten girls basketball, and saw a positive value for myself and others in that. And I would also just say that where we need to look at the local level means that we have to make sure that policies that kill institutions or try to back them into corners, we have to get rid of those or weaken those or reform those. And so sometimes there are people who don't like the idea of churches and religious organizations getting involved, Catholic running hospitals or that sort of thing. They say, your job is to, lead worship and spirituality, stay out of civil society. And a lot of this fight happens, the religious liberty fights are over that. I think that I would like to tell people who disagree with religious institutions, okay, but let them do their good work without really trying to interfere with them, because that, again, is going to be the backbone of the American dream. And on a secular level, I would say that counties and states moving control over schools to as local a level as possible would be a big gain. People always ask me, are there secular things that can do what you talk about the churches doing? And I say, yeah, I'm from New York. I know people in New England where the local schools really are controlled by the town. So then they become these defining institutions. The high school where I grew up, that was what made our town, and we had control over it. That should happen. In my current county, Montgomery County, Maryland, there's no local control over schools. There's no... Our high school, JFK, doesn't have any other boundaries around it. There's no control over it. It's run by the county, which runs a dozen schools. So that would be one public policy proposal that states and counties can carry out, is give people control over their community. And that gives them not only a sense of purpose, also the modeling, also the safety net to allow them to have the infrastructure around which you build a good life.
Wanted to kind of switch over to the 2020 election as it gets underway. How could political stakeholders, candidates, campaigns, and donors reach out to and support alienated Americans and America more broadly?
It's tricky, because one of the things that made Trump appeal was just sort of articulating the pain that people suffer. And that'll always be step one. Now, the problem is politicians are always good at talking and not necessarily acting. But, I mean, it's an important step one. I thought Hillary Clinton was incredibly tone deaf to go to Michigan right before the election and to say, the American dream is as alive and well as it's ever been. How does that sound to somebody who remembers a strong town where people had a real ladder and access to climb up the ladder, and now they don't? And so trying not to demean and diminish their actual suffering, it would be the first way that I would look for, to acknowledge that this is real and to acknowledge that the roots of it are not purely economic, I think would be good. To say this has to do with the fact that your communities have crumbled. And to acknowledge that the repair is going to happen at the community level, and that what you as a presidential, senatorial, congressional candidate can do is provide some support, but also make sure that nobody's interfering with your ability to build those. So a lot of that is going to be messaging. But again, that's a lot of what Trump's appeal was, which is going to these places. And he went to Monessen down there in the Monongahela Valley in Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh. And he articulated their despair and sense of loss. And to do that, and do it in a positive way that acknowledges that Washington's not going to be the solution. That's what I would love to see in a politician, is somebody say, you've had this great loss. The solution is going to come from where you are. And I'm going to make sure that I'm on your side to the degree I can be and not getting in your way.
How can the media highlight the issue of alienated America and provide helpful reporting?
I think that looking beyond the purely economic explanations is the first step. And trying to deal with people on their own terms. There's this bad habit in the press when somebody says something to respond with, oh, so what you're saying is, and filling in the blanks. But instead, to deal with people on their own terms and not to assume sort of ill will. I think that those are the two types of reporting that we've had, is people who just tried to give a purely economic account for it, or people who, when they gave a cultural account for the suffering, chalked it up to bigotry instead of alienation. So a better job of understanding that. And it's tricky, because I find that people who live in places that have really suffered under alienation often love where they live and will be very protective of it, and then can open up to lamenting how it doesn't have what it needs to have and what it used to have. So sometimes if I showed up and said, I came to your county because by all measures it's falling apart, they'd say, you have no idea what it's talking about, we're great. And then within an hour, they're telling me about how there aren't these strong bonds. Listening was, you know, and understanding the complex messages was a much harder undertaking than, you know, you might first imagine.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. As we close, could you expound on whether you feel more hopeful or less hopeful about the American dream today?
I think what makes me feel more hopeful is that that it's not a problem of sort of our souls having gotten worse or anything, that the American people still are who we are, but that seeing that how effective a handful of strong institutions can be in changing the nature of a community, looking at the working class places, or at least middle class places I saw, like Oostburg, Wisconsin, or Orange City, Iowa. These are places that on a material level don't have much more than the real alienated places have. But what they've done is build and maintain very strong church communities. So that's made me think we don't need to totally change the U.S. economy. We don't need to change the character of Americans in order to turn things around. We need to just figure out how to plant and make stick strong institutions in the places that are currently suffering from alienation.
Thank you so much, Tim. It was a pleasure talking to you. I'm Mary Pincus, and I've been speaking with Timothy Carney, author of Alienated America.